Season 1 of Island Crime debuted recently with the story of Lisa Marie Young, a Nanaimo cold case. The podcast entitled Where Is Lisa is now one of the top two crime podcasts in the country.
In the short period of time since I released the first episodes of Season 1, there has been a deluge of interest in Lisa Marie Young's case.
The city of Nanaimo is still haunted by the disappearance of 21-year-old Lisa Marie Young, who went missing over the Canada Day weekend in 2002. The case remains unsolved, but her story is gaining attention again thanks to a new true crime podcast.
Those responsible for her death are sleeping a little less easily, I suspect. And that is a very good thing. It's the start of the summer 2020. The anniversary of Lisa Marie Young's disappearance is near. She is in my mind often, as is her mom, Joanne. The annual March for Justice for Lisa, which Joanne championed year after year, is just around the corner.
Where is Lisa? Where is Lisa?
This year's march will take place amidst growing outrage over a number of violent incidents involving police and Indigenous people. There are increasing demands to address the kind of systemic racism which I believe was present in the investigation into Lisa Marie Young's case. And there is also a new campaign for Lisa. People are being asked to leave their porch lights on for Lisa on the anniversary of the night she didn't come home. The lights are a sign of hope. I think of all those little lights flickering in the darkness. I think of Dawn and Joanne Young on that evening all those years ago, waiting for their daughter to come home. And I think of how their hope faded over the years. But now, finally, there are flickers of light. I'm Laura Palmer. You're listening to Island Crime, Season 1. Where is Lisa? This is Episode 7. Ahead, a witness, and one that got away. I've been, frankly, blown away by the response to this podcast so far. I've been overwhelmed with people who are coming forward with support and information about Lisa Marie's disappearance. The Facebook advocacy group for Lisa has almost doubled in size, swelling to nearly 1,000 people. Many of those who live in Lisa Marie's hometown are speaking out. They're calling for justice, and they're sharing their memories of Lisa. A local detective tells me she has shared the podcast with an association of private investigators. I hear from someone who knew a police officer involved in the investigation. He tells me the police know who did it. They just never had the evidence to make the case. A man who heard the information from Dave in episode 5 about how Lisa's body was first disposed of in a well shares his expertise. He has knowledge of wells, and he points to a map of all wells in the area, new and old. And there are questions. In episode 4, psychic Norm Pratt said a bag of identification was found while they were in the woods looking for Lisa. A listener asks, what became of that bag? The answer? Norm tells me it was handed over to the police, but that nothing came of it. Lisa's story is reaching people, sparking memories and introspection. Here's listener and broadcaster Cam Moon.
Great work on the first season of your podcast. You did an incredible job of telling this story. Plenty of interviews really helped shape the picture. I was drawn to it because I used to live in Nanaimo. I was there from 1995 to 98. You had said in the podcast that Lisa Marie wanted to be a sports broadcaster. Well, that's what my job was when I lived there. I did the sports and the play-by-play for the Nanaimo Clippers of the BC Hockey League on what was then CKG 1570, which is now 106.9 The Wolf and 102.3 The Wave. Lisa Marie would have been 14 to 16 while I was there. Did she listen to Clipper games? Did she come to some of the games? Did I see her at the rink? I couldn't help but think of those questions while I listened. It's an incredibly sad story. I really feel for the family. I hope something comes from this podcast and someone is brought to justice.
I'm determined to follow up on as much as I can. In this episode, you'll hear from two of the people who have stepped forward into the light with relevant and important information. When I began researching Lisa's case, I wanted to hear from those who were out at the jungle that night. And I was also keen to learn more about what Dallas Hulley knew. Dallas, you will recall, is the friend Lisa called for help while she was stuck in the car, unable to leave. Just after I begin publishing episodes, a woman steps up. She was working at the jungle that night. She knew Dallas. He shared his story with her. I know who she is, and I'm confident in the legitimacy of her perspective. But she has asked that I not identify her, and I'm respecting that request.
Well, I am 42. I'm a little bit older than Lisa would be. And I've pretty much grown up in Nanaimo my whole life. My husband and I both went to school here. And I'm a teacher and a martial artist. And I've worked many waitressing jobs throughout my university time here in Nanaimo. And so I was at the jungle working the night that Lisa disappeared.
I've never been inside the jungle. Can you tell me what it was like? What was it like to be working there back then?
It was a crazy time. It was a kind of in the heyday of that place, I kind of think. That nightlife at that time was action-packed and crazy at times. There were, you know, wet t-shirt contests. There were nights where there were dollar highballs and just, you know, tables full of drinks. And it was just, it was madness. But you know, a lot of people knew each other.
Again, as slowly and in as much detail as you can recall, talk to me about specifically what you saw that night as it relates to Lisa's case.
Sure, I'll do my best. So this was so long ago that my memory is patchy. I do think I have a pretty good memory for certain things, and particularly for conversations about that and that night, because it, of course, what happened, quite vivid in my mind. But, you know, I realize that some parts of what I remember are perhaps things that I've read. And so I'll do my best to kind of delineate between what I remember very clearly and what I'm not so clear on. So what I do remember very clearly was at closing time, I was chatting with Dallas before he left because he was feeling pretty good. I remember him being a little bit intoxicated, and he was outside and he had one male friend with him, and it was his birthday, and he mentioned that. And so I don't know why, but that stuck in my mind. I just remembered him at closing time outside and he was leaving, and I did not see Lisa with him. I don't remember seeing her in the club that night, but I do remember him leaving. I do remember the Jaguar. The guy in the Jag was kind of cruising by, and I'm not sure if he and Dallas had, at that point, like if he had already talked to him or what happened. I didn't really make any connection with that until later when Dallas told me more about that evening and what happened after the club.
So you mentioned earlier that as someone who worked at the club, you obviously knew some of the people who came and went there. Is that how you knew Dallas?
No, actually. So I knew Dallas a few different ways. So my boyfriend at the time was also a prize fighter. And so you think you're tough, so you want to fight, I think is what they were called. Those fights were huge events at that time. And it was a bit of a social scene in and of itself to go to those fights and see people there. And so I had a little bit of insight into that community, having, my boyfriend at the time.
All right, I'm going to stop you there for a second. I'm just going to with my dog. So that is interesting, that whole world of prize fighting and, just seems to be a bit of a backdrop for this whole story. So that's how you came to know Dallas.
Yeah, that's how I knew Dallas. And also my good friend that I was living with, at that time, she worked with him at Thrifty's, I think, as well. And, pretty charismatic. I remembered him very well.
So he's a character in the story, although of course he is deceased as well. So I can't talk to him. I do want to ask you obviously about that conversation you had with him. But before that, can you just tell me a little bit more about him? What was he like? What kind of a guy was he?
So I didn't know him well, but I would say he was an acquaintance. And so, and I saw him, quite a bit in the nightclub and that sort of thing, but he was a very, in my experience, he was a really happy guy. He was very friendly, high energy, street smart, good looking, charismatic guy. And he was pretty flirty sometimes, but he was always super kind. And I always remember that about him. He was always a gentleman. I never had any bad experiences with Dallas. He was a super nice guy as far as I knew and could tell.
So how is it you came to have a conversation with Dallas about what happened that night?
It was either a few days up to maybe a week after Lisa's disappearance. We knew about it. There was, in fact, a poster on the telephone pole right outside my house within a couple days. And there was mention of this Jaguar and this fellow that had been driving it in the poster. So we knew she was missing, and it was something that we all knew about, and it was on everybody's mind. So we ran into Dallas. We were at the river, the Nanaimo River, and at the time, again, that was a bit of a social scene as well. Everyone would go down to the river. There's certain hot spots, beautiful natural setting, but lots of people, sunbathing, hanging out, some people drinking and so on, and just enjoying the place and cooling off in the summer. So my friend and I were there for a swim in the daytime, and there Dallas was there too, and we ran into him, and he climbed up on the rocks to kind of chat with us and say hi. And then he somehow this conversation came up about Lisa, and then he told us that he had been hanging out with her that night, and this was the first time I had seen him since saying goodbye at the end of the night on his birthday. So I had no idea. And so he proceeded to tell us everything that he knew of from that night. And he seemed in good spirits, but he also seemed like he maybe had been partying. I don't really know. For a few days, perhaps, hard to say. He seemed a little bit exhausted. He did mention that he had been questioned for, I can't remember, like 9 hours or something like that. And that was within days of us kind of running into him. And he did mention Yeah, so I was the last person to talk to her, and so he, I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Some of it is patchy. So he said that at some point in the night, and I'm not sure if it was right after the jungle or not, that he was out partying. It was his birthday, and he had gone to a couple house parties, and that Lisa was with them. At least at the first party. So they went from the jungle, my understanding of what he said was they went from the jungle to a party out in somewhere like Cedar, the south end of Nanaimo somewhere, is what I thought he said. And then they went to a second party somewhere in the Quarter Way pub area, which is kind of close proximity to Bowen Road. That's my recollection of what he said. And he said that Lisa was with them at some point in the night at this first party. Now, I'm not sure if they got together before that and the guy in the jet drove them there or if they met up at that party. That part I'm not so sure of. But he did mention that this guy in the jet, and it was a burgundy Jaguar, offered to drive them around, like from party to party type thing. And he said, well, of course, you know, we said, yeah, this guy seemed like he was somewhat sober, and he offered to drive them, so they agreed, and that was okay. But I did not get an impression that Dallas was the guy. So he never used his name or anything like that. And I read later that there was some question of that, but that was not my impression at all. And then he mentioned that, so they went to this first party, and he said that, yes, you know, he said, yeah, the guy was hitting on Lisa, but, you know, of course, so was I, kind of thing. Just innocent flirting or whatever is kind of the impression I got. And then he said they went from that party out in the South End to a second party, and he mentioned that the second party, there was a barbecue, and that Lisa was a vegetarian, and that this guy in the jet had offered to drive her to Subway, specifically, to get something because she obviously wasn't going to eat any of the meat because she's a vegetarian. And so that, I think he said that was around, I don't know, 3 a.m. or something like that. And then after that, the guy took her in the Jag and to go to Subway, but then she ended up phoning Dallas and saying, the guy won't let me leave. He's creeping me out. And Dallas said, and she mentioned that they were in a driveway somewhere on Bowen Road, but she didn't really know exactly where. And that's all I really know. And then Dallas mentioned that she, after that, texted him as well. And in that text, she said, they won't let me leave. And that's all I really know. And he said that he was too wasted, and he was with other people, I don't know who. But he said, yeah, we were too wasted to really do anything about it, to go anywhere. And that he told her to just get out of the car and just call a cab. And that was the last that he heard from her. Yeah.
Wow. So here you are talking to him, and this is just, you know, a week or days after the fact. Did you get any sense at all that there were things he wasn't saying, or that he was, you know?
That's completely my gut.
Yeah.
Feeling, and nothing factual at all. My instinct told me that, yes, there was something he wasn't saying. And I don't know what, you know, my guess was perhaps there was some drug use going on. I just felt like there was something, some things didn't make sense. I don't know. It was just very strange. Very strange to me.
You said he seemed at that point as if he'd been maybe not getting much sleep or partying or whatever, but he did tell you that he had been questioned at length by the police. Is that right?
He did. He did. Yeah. He said they had questioned him, and he had been in the station or wherever the questioning happened. They took him in there and they didn't let him leave for a long time. And he said they asked him the same things over and over and over.
One of the things that I just was never clear on was to what extent people at the jungle were talked to after this all happened, and also what was being said, you know, amongst staff. So can you shed any light on those things?
I wasn't questioned, and no one ever mentioned that they were questioned, but I can't say that they weren't. But, you know, there was definitely not a police presence that I know of at the jungle for, you know, talking to anybody, although maybe that happened to other people and not to myself. I don't really know.
This all happened a very long time ago, but as someone who, you know, is part of this community, can you reflect at all on what it means for you and for the community that there has been no resolution to this case?
I have sleepless nights over it. I sometimes think about it and start reading things, and I can't sleep at night. I feel it's terrible. It's justice just hasn't happened, and it's not right.
You know, when you think back on that conversation with Dallas by the river, you know, because I can't talk to him. I'm so grateful that you're relaying this information. Is there anything, any impression, anything that just when you think back on that memory, anything that stands out to you about that conversation now?
At the time, I was surprised at how maybe, I don't know what the word is. I don't want to say nonchalant, but I was kind of surprised at how lighthearted Dallas seemed to be about the whole thing. But at the same time, I know that people react to trauma in very different ways, and that could be normal for some people and a coping mechanism, you know. I can't help but think that Dallas probably felt some deep sense of guilt, you know, no matter what happened. I always thought about Dallas, and I always thought that he was a kind guy, and I felt like he was being genuine about what he said, but then I felt that there was maybe things that he wasn't saying, but that's all I could really, you know, that's all that I could really say, because I didn't really know anything except for what he said.
So, that interview answered a few questions, and it raised a few for me as well. I get a better sense of the club scene. The cheap drinks, the wet t-shirt contest, paint a clearer picture in my mind of that period. And Dallas, too, is taking shape as a character for me. I can almost picture him on the river's edge that day. The fatigue, the guilt, and then there's that lingering doubt as to whether he was holding back something, some piece of information. A few days after that interview, I get a call. There was something she was holding back. After we spoke, you called me back to say that there was something else Dallas had said that day, all those years ago, something that you held back. What did he say?
Well, I have to explain that I was reluctant to say this because I think that as people, you know, we're kind of reluctant to say anything that might reflect negatively on someone that's passed away. And so I struggled with it quite a bit, even though I think it's very important. So that's why I phoned back. He said, in the context of telling us what happened to Lisa that night, or what he knew of what happened, he said that jokingly, I did it, and I buried her under my porch. And I was shocked. I didn't really know what to think of that, and it just always sat so uneasy with me. I think I rationalized it in terms of, you know, like I said before, people deal with trauma in different ways, and for some people, maybe that's normal to kind of make a joke or seem kind of nonchalant about something that's really serious. But yeah, it was just so strange.
Previously, when you talked about Dallas, sort of talked about him being a kind of charismatic, energetic, fun guy. And he is, of course, deceased. Can you just, you know, talk to me about, you know, why you thought it was important to call me back and describe this moment, which frankly doesn't really cast him in a positive light?
I think any information that can come out could be helpful. And I think that there's power in the truth, and part of me was kind of scared. Part of me was reluctant to talk about that, but ultimately I think I struggled with it and realized that it's Lisa's memory is what needs to be honored. And so if I could, you know, contribute something that will help to bring her home and solve this, then I have to do it.
I wonder why the police didn't interview this woman. Surely, her witnessing two of the last people known to have been with Lisa that night is relevant.
And finally, there's that mention that the is flirting with Lisa that night. The next voice you will hear is that of a young woman who is coming forward with her own experience with. I'm also protecting her identity. She is fearful of speaking out, and yet she may hold a key to unlocking a part of this story. It's now summer 2020. But January has set in. It's cool and raining as I head out onto the highway once again. The interview I am about to do will be difficult. There is a lot at stake. As I drive down an especially steep, winding stretch of road, rain pelting the windshield, I'm aware a dark-colored SUV is following too closely behind me. I check my rearview mirror. Still there. Still too close. Since the podcast has been published, I've had moments where I worry about my own safety. And this is one of them. There are people who would prefer Lisa's story remain in the darkness. So I'm being careful. My guard is up. Still, I take comfort in the beauty of the West Coast island around me. As I approach my destination, the rain lightens. Two giant eagles soar overhead. After the first few episodes dropped, I began seeing some reaction from women which had a similar theme. I could have been Lisa. These are mostly from women who think back on their own youth and recall encounters that could easily have gone very badly. Today, I'm driving across the island to meet one of those women, a woman whose story could help shed some light on Lisa's case. This woman first reached out to me a few weeks after the first podcast aired.
I reached out to you, Laura, asking if you were a reporter.
Me. I'm the host and producer of Where is Lisa? Season 1 of Violent Crime. What's up?
And I responded in confidence, knowing it was you. I am an island resident that knew the and one night I remember ending up alone at his place, as he didn't live very far. Why I went there, I don't know, but it wasn't long before he had me in his bathroom offering me a clear bottle of GHB and trying to have sex. I was super uncomfortable and wanted to leave, but he was extremely pushy and kept grabbing me all over, telling me it was okay. I feel like he lured me there knowing I was out of foster care and had no family here. I was so young and naive, and my body shakes when I think of Lisa and write this. I believe things could have turned out very different that night. I could have been Lisa.
The day I drive to meet her, she's staying with friends. She needs to be away from her family to do this interview. And she needs the support of those close friends. When she steps out of the house to come and meet me, I catch my breath. She looks like Lisa. She's a petite brunette. She's dressed like many young women on the island, a large, comfy plaid shirt over leggings and flats.
I will not be identifying this woman, nor will I be identifying the man in question, except to say that he is one of the people whose name has been associated with Lisa Marie Young's disappearance. Again, these are decisions I do not take lightly. I prefer my sources not to be anonymous, but I'm confident this woman is who she says she is. I believe her when she tells me she is fearful. I believe her story. And I see a public interest in having her story told.
She gets into the back seat, and we're able to maintain a social distance. These interviews are now happening in the time of the pandemic.
So I am an island resident. I've lived on Vancouver Island almost my entire life. I am a mother, and I'm just actually 10 days older than Lisa Marie.
Can you just sort of walk yourself back in time for me and talk to me about your life then? What was going on in your life?
I graduated from school in 99, and about 2000, I ended up renting a house with two of my longtime girlfriends. And while we were young, we were wild, we were having a lot of fun. And when I turned 19, we would frequent, you know, the press room, the Grizzly Bar, the Palace, the Jungle, all those bars on the strip. And it was very wild times. Things were crazy. And often we'd bring the party back home and, you know, we would just live free and have fun. And, you know, our house would be filled with people. A lot of the time we would be having a lot of ongoing, you know, parties and stuff, and people coming in and out and just being young and free.
I've heard people describe the kind of club scene, party scene, social scene as being wild. And the idea of being young and free, I think a lot of us can relate to that.
Yeah.
Despite my graying hair, I too had that experience. Mm-hmm. But can you just, like, in a little more detail, tell me about what you mean when you say kind of wild. What are we talking about?
Well, we like to go to raves. We like to have long weekends of parties and bring it home and, you know, just go with the flow. And I wasn't ready to go off to college yet. So, you know, we were just having fun, partying and, you know, meeting and integrating with all these different people. The rave scene was pretty unique group of people. There was people from all walks of life. And, you know, growing up in District 69, there was a lot of, as we say, cliques, you know. So I found it was hard going to both schools in that district. But when I entered the rave scene, people seemed to be much more accepting and this ended up with quite an eclectic group of people, let's say.
The rave scene, there will be people listening who just don't know what that means. What the rave scene is, what?
Well, in the late 90s, it was still very underground, but we were definitely introduced to, you know, ecstasy and stuff like that. And not always living with discretion, you know, taking some risk, living a little bit more of a risky lifestyle, but still feeling safe in our circle in what we were doing at the time.
But there's something about that time that you now look back on with some anxiety. I don't know exactly how to say it, but you emailed me after listening to the podcast. Mm-hmm. Can you just slowly and in as much detail as you're comfortable with, talk to me about what it is you experienced and, well, let's just start with that.
Sure. So Friday night, I received a phone call from a friend asking me if I had listened to a podcast regarding Lisa Marie. We are both very aware of Lisa Marie's story, not in full depth, but we know the story. We see the posters and we've heard the rumors. So instantly I related to what she was talking about, and I started straight away. We kind of go back and forth about different documentaries. We're very into crime, like shows and stuff like that. So I quickly jumped onto Spotify and started listening to the podcast. And the first segment was obviously about Lisa Marie's life and painting a picture of who she was. So, you know, you instantly feel a little more connected to the story and herself. And then when I got a couple more episodes in, they described, and that was a trigger, definitely. Something I don't think about every day, but when this came up and I heard other details about this story, it definitely triggered me and hit me hard.
You mentioned that you are close to Lisa Marie's age, and you have been to some of those same places. You're listening to the podcast. What was it that triggered you, or as you say, triggered you in a very hard way?
Well, because I realized that I had been with I knew him, I knew his family. And one night when we were all having a house party just down the road, we didn't live far from each other, he ended up at the house. And I didn't really make anything of it, just going about the night. And somehow I ended up making my way back to his place alone. I don't know why, but it wasn't long before he did have me in his bathroom, pushing me up against the sink, the vanity. And he was offering me GHB. And at that time, I was still only maybe 19, I was pretty street savvy. I was pretty street smart. I knew about the underground life, and I knew what GHB was, and I knew what it potentially could have done to me. And I refused. And he was very persistent, and he kept grabbing my body and trying to persuade me to go farther. And I don't know what it was. I knew I had broken the golden rule, not going alone with somebody like that, you know, but somehow I managed to get out of the house and back to our place. And, you know, I just, it never sat well with me. I knew it could have been a dangerous situation once I got through the doorway and realized what was going on. But for some reason, I was able to leave and get back. I don't know if it was people knew I had gone there with him, or, you know, somebody was reaching out, or I had to be back. But I ended up leaving the building and going back to our place of residence at that time.
What do you remember about leaving that place? And I guess if you could just paint me a little bit of a picture of, you know, the neighborhood, his place, that just kind of take me there as much as you can. And again, as much as you're comfortable with.
Yeah, so our place of residence was right downtown Parksville, and there was a couple friends that would frequent the house that lived about in a 4-5 block radius, I'd say, and did not live far. It was a walking distance, and all I remember, I can't quite remember, I believe it was an apartment building, because there's quite a few like condo settings right around that area, and all I remember really of his house is going in, and then to the left there was the bathroom, and almost getting shuffled right in there. So really leaving, it just all happened really fast and emotions were high. My adrenaline was going. I felt really cornered and alone in that moment. And it just kind of went blank. It was just self-preservation, get out of this situation, go back to my group of people where I know I'm safe.
And you mentioned that in that period when you're in the house alone with him, he's being persistent. Can you do you have any recollection of what was being said, what he was doing?
Just groping me, trying to pull at my clothes, kissing me, saying it's all right, it's okay, like I'll take you back soon kind of thing. I don't know, like I say, it just happened really fast, it seems, and it was almost 20 years ago now, so you kind of just try to put that stuff out of your mind. And honestly, I had a boyfriend at the time, so, you know, the desire to divulge what had happened and the situation that I had put myself in was not at the forefront. It was kind of, okay, we escaped an awkward, serious situation, let's just continue on.
You were in care at some point in your life?
Yes.
Is there any part of you that wonders if that's why or how you ended up in that situation, or that you were targeted because of that?
It definitely crosses my mind. Being a ward of the court, not having family, no brothers or sisters, simply, you know, a group of friends that came and went. Yeah, I believe perhaps he did lure me over there, knowing that I didn't have much of a web behind me.
I have been told by other people that he, you know, if I met him, I would think he was quite charming.
Absolutely. So, yeah, pretty suave kind of character. Had that nice haircut, was older, pretty established, as we all kind of, you know, guessed.
I want to just go back to like the period immediately after. You have a boyfriend. This isn't something you want to like really get into, obviously. But what impact does that have on you as a young person at that point in your life?
But I think I was quite reserved after that for a while. My relationship didn't work out. I moved away. Things were a little bit tough, but I just took it as that was just finding myself in the world.
You made the decision to, you know, send me that first email, and, you know, we've had a back and forth since then. What is it that made you think it was time?
I just think that with you shedding new light to the story and having a personal experience, that there's possibly other people out there that may have some information or a personal experience. I personally didn't know Lisa at the time, but I have very close friends that knew her personally. And I just felt like it was something that I needed to do to maybe help bring others forward and realize that this suave character that painted a picture of himself was nothing of the man that he was.
If there's somebody listening right now who knows something, who maybe has been fearful of coming forward, or, you know, who has compromised themselves in some way, what do you want them to know? What do you want them to think about now?
I mean, it's just important. Think about if that was your daughter, your sister, your friend, if you had information or a situation that could potentially lead to solving this crime, this disappearance, to give the family and the community closure, I think it's an important thing to do.
Do you feel like you have the support you need now? You've talked about this being triggering. Are you okay?
I'm okay. I am. I mean, it's a sordid detail of my past, but it's just a small situation that I'm glad didn't turn into a fatal situation.
I've tried throughout to be transparent about my process. There is rightly a lot of mistrust about how the media operates. I struggle with the decision regarding airing this interview. This is just one perspective on an encounter that happened nearly 20 years ago. There are no corroborating witnesses, but I believe her story. I want to hear his side. I circle back to my contacts, and I do manage to reach one news source close to him. But no one knows where he is, and I'm told he moves around a lot. Once again, if you want to add your voice to this story, please get in touch at laurapalmer.ca. Ahead in episode 8, an interview I have been trying to get for almost 9 months. I have just recorded a lengthy interview with the RCMP. You will finally get to hear from them. I'm Laura Palmer. You're listening to Where is Lisa? Season 1 of Island Crime. If you haven't already subscribed, you'll want to do so now, so you don't miss the revelations ahead from the police. And please do rate and review this podcast. I'm new to this whole true crime podcast world, and those reviews, well, they really do help. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crime.